Today I want to talk about how to devise a business idea that will really fit you well. And then I'm going to show you how to evaluate its ability to grow. Now, during the presentation today, you're going to want to take some notes or possibly do some calculations. So I really suggest that you get yourself a piece of paper and a pen while I'm going over some of the slides. Let me start off by dispelling a misconception. I've gotten the feeling from talking to a lot of potential boomer entrepreneurs over the years that some people think there's just one perfect time in their life or one perfect time in the year to start a business. And this really isn't true. There's never really a bad time to launch a business. And why is this? Well, consumers and businesses have problems, and they're looking for solutions. A really good new idea to solve their problem is always much appreciated. So you really can launch a company anytime as long as you understand the need in the marketplace and you're prepared to satisfy it. As a matter of fact, let me share with you some world-class companies that started during economic downturns. The first is Revlon, the cosmetics giant. This was started right in the middle of the Great Depression in 1932. And then the next two names you'll see on the slide were started, Microsoft and FedEx, were started in 1973. Now, I happen to know quite a bit about this recession personally because it's the recession that I entered when I graduated from UVA from 1971 to 73. And the last item on this list is the Apple iPod. Now, this technically was not launched during an economic downturn, but it was launched 6 days after 9/11. So obviously they knew what they wanted to do in the marketplace. They were prepared to get out there with their message, and they weren't going to be deterred by the fact that there had been this national disaster. Now, in working with boomer entrepreneurs for 25 years or so, I've discovered that one of the main reasons that talented people don't move ahead with their entrepreneurial interest is that they just can't develop confidence in their business idea. And there are three main reasons that I've discovered that people have this reluctance. And I'm going to show you some ways today to help overcome these reluctances. The first is that we're all afraid of the unknown. And going from the relative security and regularity of a corporate job to starting your own company can create a lot of unknowns. Number two is many people feel overwhelmed by what seems to be a very complex process of starting a business. And third, we're not sure that we can do everything we need to do to run the business all by ourselves. Let me share some good news with you. You do not have to reinvent the wheel to be a very successful entrepreneur. As a matter of fact, very few new businesses started in the United States are started with a concept that's totally new that nobody else has done. And let me just share a little example of my company, BizStarters.com, and how we didn't really reinvent the wheel, but we've been quite successful in what we've done. I discovered from helping volunteer with a couple of friends who had bought businesses after they left the corporate world, they were having problems with these companies and asked if I could come in, take a look, and see if we could figure out a plan to keep them alive. Well, fortunately, we were successful in both cases. But what I learned in doing this was that even though my friends had MBAs, they really did not know a lot about how to run a business. And what I discovered is that the difference between success and failure for them wasn't that they had to do their business in a totally new way. They just had to be 10% better than their competitors. And that's really all it took for them to succeed in this. So after I realized that this didn't require that I completely reinvent the teaching how you start a business, I sat down and made a list of all the different tasks and decisions that you would need to make in order to start a business. And then I went out and I examined how you would go about obtaining these resources. And I discovered that you'd have to go to more than a dozen different places. Now, obviously, this was in the early 90s before the internet came along, and today it's much easier to do this. But out of this whole process of evaluating the business startup process step by step, I developed a mantra, which has been our success story, and that is our clients never have to wonder what to do next. So we didn't invent the whole new industry, but we innovated. I consider myself an innovative thinker and not somebody who's going to create a whole new industry. Now let's look at a series of really popular ways today to come up with a business idea. The first is to sell your expert knowledge and connections. The most common way we see this being done is through what are called consultancies or consulting businesses. And let me share a client example with you to illustrate how you go about doing this. Deb Martin has been an industrial engineer for more than 30 years, the last 7 working for the Oscar Mayer division of Kraft, based here in suburban Chicago. When she was given an opportunity to take an early retirement offer about a year ago when Kraft merged with Heinz, she knew exactly what she wanted to do. She wanted to create a consulting company to do one specific mission. She wanted to be able to bring the sophistication of Fortune 500 manufacturing technology to smaller manufacturers. Now, Deb is located in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a couple of hours north of Milwaukee, right in the middle of a very dense population of small business manufacturers, both in Wisconsin and Illinois. And very few of these companies are large enough to have someone on staff full-time with Deb's experience. So Deb's business basically is taking all the experience and knowledge and insider tips that she's learned over 30 years, and she sells it project by project to companies who want the benefit but can't afford to hire someone like her full-time. The second way to find a business idea is to use your job experience to sell a service. Now, this type of business startup can be a bit more expensive than starting a consultancy because you may need special equipment, you might need a special vehicle, and you might need a couple of part-time employees in order to sell the service. Now, let me give you an example of how you go about doing this. Walter Miller is my accounting advisor. He owns a company called Norman Professional Services based in suburban Chicago. Before starting this company, Norman was a corporate accounting manager. And in the process of doing his day in and day out work, he was constantly looking for new tools and new approaches to make this work more effectively. And he started hearing about 15, 18 years ago about something called QuickBooks accounting software, and decided to look into this and discovered that the product was very powerful, so powerful that a lot of small businesses did not know how to use the software correctly. They would buy it, and in some cases they wouldn't even get it installed on their computers because they didn't know how to do it. So Walter left the corporate world to start what is now one of the top QuickBooks consulting companies in the United States. Now, he did have to invest a pretty good piece of change to start this. First of all, he had to pay for advanced training for himself and a couple of employees in order to become certified QuickBooks consultants, which once you do that, you then are entered into a national network of certified providers that people can search on the web. He also had some additional costs in that he had to have outside space to house his employees, and of course he had to buy computer equipment. So his investment was probably quite a bit more than Deb and her consulting company, but Norman knew exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to turn a corporate skill into a much-needed business service. The next popular way to find a business idea today is to sell a craft or fashion item online. Now, over the past 5 or 6 years, I've had the pleasure of working with about a dozen people who wanted to do exactly this. And in most cases, what I've discovered is they started out doing the craft or fashion work as a hobby. And then got to a certain point in their life where they wanted to do it as a full-time business. This is an example of one of our clients. Wired Lotus is a company that produces high-quality wire jewelry, bracelets, necklaces, pins. This was started by Susan Barrazzini. She started working this business at home. And when I met her, she was looking to go outside and have a retail location. We helped her to develop her own selling site. She had previously sold only on Etsy. And we were able to help her convert to her own selling site, which you see here. This is an example of the new website we helped her build. She now also has a retail space where she can run a more traditional jewelry store, and also she provides step-by-step courses on how to produce jewelry. And she now has a training space at the back end of her retail store to do this. And the fourth way I see people turning experience and interest into really great ideas today is to sell coaching and training. Now, this is the essence of my company, BizStarters.com. We sell coaching and training in a wide variety of styles. We sell guides, we sell workbooks, we sell online courses, we sell live coaching, we sell group coaching, we sell one-on-one coaching. We probably have 12 different ways that we make money from doing this, but it's all based on coaching and training. So let me share an example of how you go about doing this. Networlding is run by my longtime entrepreneurial friend, Melissa Wilson. In the process of writing and publishing a dozen books over the last 20 years, Melissa has learned everything you need to know about both writing and publishing books. And today, the primary product that Networlding sells is a multi-week online course with coaching to help people who are experts in a particular topic write their first book. And once they write the book, Melissa's firm then helps you to create a business around the book, such as adding workshops, coaching, public speaking. Now, you're probably wondering at this point, how do you come up with a business idea like Deb and Walter and Melissa? Well, let me go through the process that I have guided clients through hundreds of times over the last 25 years. And you might want to start taking some notes at this point, so I hope you have that piece of paper and pen in front of you. The first step is to describe yourself. So let's take our blank piece of paper. In the upper left-hand corner of the paper, write down 5 to 7 things that you really like to do or that you're really good at doing. Now, I know you probably won't have time during our call to complete this exercise, but I would really encourage you, as soon as you get off the call, to come back to the exercise and finish what you started. Now, on the other side of the paper, on the upper right-hand side, write down 3 or 4 things you really do not like to do or you don't feel you're really good at. For example, I don't like public speaking. Now, you may be asking, why would you write down things you don't want to do since we're trying to find a business idea here? Well, I will tell you from the many years of experience I've had working with new entrepreneurs that many times picking a business idea has as much to do with what you don't want to do as it does with what you want to do. So you really need to think about both of them. Now, after you've had a chance to fill in both the left and right side completely, which, as I said, is probably going to take you some time after this call to finish, at the bottom left corner of the paper, let's do a little summary. Let's write down your top 2 things that you really like to do or you're really good at doing. And next to it, write down 1 or 2 things you really don't like to do or don't want to do. This is going to be the guide for moving you forward. And let me just give you an example once again for my company. Why did I create BizStarters.com? Well, it started originally because I love to teach. My mother was a teacher, and she taught me that it's not enough to learn something. You have to also share it with other people. It was almost like a social responsibility in my family. So my first gig at training was when I was 15 years old. I helped my father coach a Little League team in Ohio. So this was my starting point. And by the time I got into my 30s and was living in Chicago, I had been doing volunteer teaching and training for 15 or 20 years, largely without being compensated for it. I did it as a part-time job, part-time avocation. Well, when I sat down to try to figure out what business idea I would pursue, I wrote a bunch of different ideas down on a flip chart. And I noticed that the ones that I really was attracted to the most all had to do with training people or educating people. Okay, let's move to step two. Step two is what I call what's missing. Quite often, you can find very profitable business ideas by looking in the world around you and figuring out what is missing. And let me give you an example from my company, BizStarters. I realized after my volunteer work in surveying about 100 relatively new business owners, I discovered that there was a big gap. They knew part of how to start a business, but they didn't know everything. And they couldn't find both the startup details, the coaching, and most importantly, the services they needed. They could not find these all in one place. So this was really the germ of my idea for BizStarters, was to combine the planning process, the coaching, and all the startup services in one package, priced as a package and available through our company, through a virtual incubator coach, as we call it. Step three. Another great way to find a business idea that can be profitable is to figure out what upsets you. What do you really get ticked off about in your day in and day out life? And I want to share a really world-class example of someone who has built an incredible company based on being upset. I think most of you on this call subscribe to Netflix, either the streaming service or the DVD service. I know my wife and I do. So you know what Netflix is. But what you may not know is the backstory behind how Netflix was started. The founder of Netflix, his name is Reed Hastings, and his motivation for considering how to create Netflix was pretty simple. You may remember that back in the, particularly in the 1980s, there was a chain of video stores called Blockbuster. Excuse me. And what motivated Reed was he had forgotten to take back a video. Maybe it was like 2 weeks late. He takes it back to the Blockbuster store, and they charged him $40 late fee. Well, Reed was a very experienced computer industry executive, so he knew something about creating products for the Internet. And he sat down and said to himself, why can't you rent videos the same way you have a gym club membership? Why can't you pay a flat fee and go as many times every month as you want? And that's the way Netflix works. If you are quick enough, you can watch a movie every day, send it back to Netflix, and get a new one. So you potentially could have 15, 18, 20 movies a month. And this was his big breakthrough. This is how he's built a multi-billion dollar company. But it all went back to the fact that something that personally made Reed Hastings mad created his company. Now, step four is to look at what I call the tried and true. As I said a few slides back, you don't have to reinvent the wheel to be successful in coming up with your own business idea. There are a lot of very successful companies that are based on something very tried and true, a commonly understood service or a commonly understood product. You can make a lot of money from this. I know living here in Chicago, we have a very interesting history of what are called the robber barons. These were men who made their fortunes in the 1800s. And one particular guy that's always struck my fancy, this guy made a $5 million fortune in the 1980s by inventing the zipper. Well, we take the zipper for granted, but before that, there was a very cumbersome way to close your pants and your jackets. This guy came up with the idea for the zipper and made a fortune at it. Now, let me give you an example of tried and true. This is one of our clients, Ann Anderson. Ann owns the company called Accel Property Management. Now, Ann was originally from Silicon Valley area of California, where she had been trained as a professional property manager. About 7 or 8 years ago, she decided to move to McAllen, Texas, way down near the Rio Grande River, because her mother lived there and her mom was getting older. Well, Ann wasn't in town very long before she realized that a lot of the condos and apartments in McAllen are owned by people who live in the northern part of the United States, and they only come there for a few months a year. which they're known as snowbirds. Well, they needed somebody to maintain and rent their units when they weren't there. And there were a couple companies in McAllen, but they weren't very sophisticated. So Ann has created a very successful company by selling a service that's pretty common, you know, renting apartments and condos, but she does it with a verve and a level of sophistication that you don't find in this particular area. And this is how she's been very successful at this. Now, step five, I call jump on the trend. What is a trend? A trend is a discernible characteristic of people. It's an activity that a lot of people are doing. And trends can be very profitable. If you know what they are and how to get on them, you can make a lot of money from this. Now, let me show you an example about how to do what's called trend analysis. When I started 25 years ago, if you wanted a trend analysis of a particular part of an industry, you had to pay a lot of money to a market research company in order to get the report. Now, these specialized reports still exist today, but for no cost and a few minutes of your time, you can do your own trend analysis very quickly. And let me show you an example. I went into Google a couple days ago in preparation for the webinar, and I put in trends in boomer travel. Let's say, for example, that I'm an experienced travel person. I maybe was even a corporate travel department type person. I've now taken early retirement or I've left the corporate world, and I'm looking for an entrepreneurial opportunity to work specifically with boomers. Well, it could be very beneficial at the front end here to know something about how are they going about their travel today. So this is the result that occurred. When I put that search term into Google, this was the very first search result that came up. It turns out that it's an article on a website called Next Avenue, which is run by PBS. And if you scroll down this article, you will learn a lot of very beneficial information about boomer travel. Okay, I promised you at the front end that I would show you how to not only come up with a business idea, but how to evaluate its ability to grow. So let's go through a series of steps here, and I would recommend that you write these steps down. Let me just adjust my light here. I don't think you can see me very well. There we go. That's better. Okay. Step one, and this goes back kind of to the whole what's missing puzzle, and that is, first of all, you need to know who else is out there doing something similar to you. I will tell you that since most of you are not going to invent a whole new industry, you already have competition. But don't worry. Competition is actually good. Because if you find three or four companies or more that are already doing something like you want to do, this means that at least one of them is making enough money to keep doing it. Or they wouldn't be out there advertising, which is what you probably saw. You saw their ad someplace. So the first thing you want to do is you want to sit down and think about what are two or three words that describe my business concept. And you want to go to Google and you want to put them in as a search. So let's take a look at an example here. This is based on a friend of mine in my neighborhood who's a master gardener. And a few years back, she decides she wants to start a part-time business selling gardening instruction and courses. So this is a search that we did several years ago. I reproduced it here on the slide. Now, the term we put in was gardening courses, and this is what came up in Google. What I recommend you do after you do this is you click on maybe the top three search listings and spend 10, 15 minutes in each website that you are led to and find out a couple of things. And here's what I suggest you look for in each of these websites that you research. Number one, what's their primary story on their homepage? What does their headline say? What does the first couple of paragraphs say? What do they say they do in their business? And number two is, do they describe who their desired customer is? Look around their website. Do they have any content that describes their customer? And then thirdly, what are their specific products and services they sell? Now, I suggest that in order to keep all this information organized, that you create an Excel spreadsheet before you do your search. and just list across the sheet horizontally the information you find from each website. So if you look at three websites, you're maybe looking at a total of 45 minutes here, but you can really learn about a lot about how you need to go ahead with your business idea. And in fact, at least once a month, I go in and I search for competitors in Boomer startup training. There aren't too many people out there, but the ones that are there, I kind of know pretty well. But I just take a look to see if anybody else has come out with a new website. And in fact, about 6 months ago, in doing this search, I discovered that there was a new listing in the top 10 for Boomer startup training. And it was a new website. I had not seen it before, so I clicked and I went and I looked. And what I discovered is that they don't really do startup training. They do training in how to use social media, specifically how to write LinkedIn profiles. Great. I think she can make a lot of money off of this. I eventually ended up calling her. She's in Canada, and we had a very friendly conversation. But she's not really a direct competitor to me. The next step is to describe who you want to sell. Now, at this point, you are not going to be very specific, because in order to do that, you're going to need market research. But you should be able to at least write something like, I want to sell to mothers who have at least one preschool-age child at home. Now, let me show you an example of a desired customer statement. You can use this kind of this layout for your own purposes here. Going back to our gardening education example, my desired customer is people age 40 and up who currently have a home garden, who like to eat fresh vegetables, and who have taken some adult education. Now, how did I come up with this? Well, the first line, the age 40 and up, we did some surveying through several large nonprofits that encourage gardening. And we discovered that the average, quote unquote, average home gardener last year was 41 years old. That's how we came up with that. Now, it doesn't mean that younger people and older people don't garden. My wife is in her late 60s and she has a garden. So anyway, at this point, you should be able to write down, once you've come up with your idea, you should be able to write down at least something that your intuition, your experience, or maybe a little bit of research tells you defines your customer. The next step is to get feedback from others. And I got to be honest with you, this is one step that prospective entrepreneurs do not like to do, because it requires talking to other people about their business idea. And they're really uncomfortable. They're afraid that people are going to tell them it's a stupid idea, they shouldn't do the idea. But you have to have some living, breathing input from doing this. I teach a class here at a high school in suburban Chicago on entrepreneurship. And as part of the curriculum, in the first month or so that they start the class, each team, we have teams of five people on a team, they're required to go out and do 100 interviews. They can be by mail, they can be online, they can be on the phone, they can be live. They can use any technique. But they're required to come back to us with the results of 100 interviews. And they do not like doing these, I can guarantee you. But every time they do them, they learn something great. Because remember, if you don't go out and get feedback, you're basing the potential success of your business idea only on your opinion. And although you're a smart person and know something about the business idea, you may not have thought of every opportunity and potential problem with your idea. So let me show you a really great tool to get information from other people. This is called SurveyMonkey. This is a free online service. They do have an upgraded version that you pay for, but what this allows you to do is you can create a survey of almost any length. It can be 3 questions, it can be 30 questions. And the tool allows you to do questions in different formats. For example, you can do yes or no. You can do check the box. You can do multiple choice. You can mix them all together. And all it requires is that you set up a free account with a name and a password. And then you can get into the tool and create a survey. And the way this works is that you figure out what information you want to get from people, and you create a series of questions. You then save it onto your account, and they give you a web address. at the very bottom of the page, they'll say, here's the address to get to the survey. You then can send out emails to 25, 30, 35 people and say, would you mind giving me 50 minutes of your time to answer a survey? And the link to the survey page is at the bottom of the email. When they click on it, it takes them to SurveyMonkey, and you can put a welcome message at the top saying, hello, hi, this is a survey for ABC, or you can have your name there. You can say, this is a survey for Jeff Williams. And they're directed on how to go down the survey, and when it gets to the end, there's a submit button. Now, once they submit the survey, this goes into a series of reports that are held on the SurveyMonkey site. You can go in using your password, and it will explain how many people answered the survey, how many people answered each question, what their answers were for each question. And if you send this out to 50 people, you'll probably get 15 or 20 people to answer it. That's valuable information. Because you can say, for example, should this product be in red or should it be in black? Should it have a handle or not have a handle? Should it be available at three different prices or one price? And you can get a lot of very valuable information. And as I said, all this takes is time. It doesn't cost anything to use SurveyMonkey. Now, obviously, you do have to get the email addresses of people you want to send this to. But I'm sure that every one of you on this call has at least 100 or 200 emails on your smartphone. Okay, the last step to evaluate your business concept, I call do some math. So I'm going to ask you at this point in time to turn your piece of paper over. So you got the blank side up again. And with your pen, we're going to go through a little bit of mathematical calculation here. Now, I'm going to give you an example, but fill in your own numbers. Now, you may not be able to finish this all during the call. So once again, I encourage you to go back after the call and finish the worksheet. So let's take a look at the worksheet here. The first thing you want to do on your piece of paper is write down the amount of money you'd like to have in the bank as a result of doing your business for the first year in business. For our example, we're going to use $30,000. Then we need to add some business expenses because the company also requires investment to keep it going. Now, we're going to suggest you use $4,800. Where did I come up with this? Well, we know from working with hundreds of startup clients a year that the average monthly cost to run their companies is between $300 and $400 a month. So we're going to take $400, be very conservative here, and we're going to multiply it by 12 months, which gives us $4,800. Now, add these two numbers together. You get $34,800. What is that number? That represents the income that your business would have to produce during the first year in order to pay you the amount of money you want and also to pay the business expenses. Now, at this point, we don't know whether that's possible or not. So let's go to the next step here. Let's go use the example of our jewelry manufacturer, Susan. And I will tell you from spending a lot of time with her talking about her product that her average selling price for her jewelry is $125. So if we divide $125 into $34,800, we end up with a number 278. This is roughly the number of units of jewelry she'd have to make and sell in a year in order to make this income amount. Now, once again, at this point, we don't know whether this is possible or not possible. This is going to require market research. It's going to require setting up an operations plan. It's going to require determining whether we need a part-time employee or we need an outside contractor. We don't have enough information yet to find out, can this be done or not done? But I can tell you that it's not such a large number that it's totally impossible to do. I have seen individuals go to jewelry shows and sell 100 pieces in one day. So 278 in 12 months is not impossible at all. Now, you may be at this point, you're thinking, what do I do next? Well, I've discovered from dealing with boomer entrepreneurs for many, many years that a really great next step can be to talk. And I'd love to have an opportunity to talk to you about your business idea or how to find a business idea or some concern you have about small business, or maybe you have specific questions that we weren't able to answer today. In order to set this up, just go to my website, bizstarters.com. You see the web address at the top of the slide. And on the right side, click on the pink button to request a free call. This will take you immediately to my calendar, where you can pick a day and time for a half an hour call, free, no obligation. Okay, let's open the line for questions.
Great, thanks so much for another really informative session about Boomer entrepreneurship. We're still waiting to see if we have some questions from the audience, but kind of like last time, I have a couple of questions if you wouldn't mind entertaining me while we wait to see what the audience comes up with. So I know toward the end you crunched some numbers to see what your income goals should be, what sales should be, and what have you. But I'm sure people may be wondering too, you know, how can I be sure that this idea that I have is going to actually make money? Is there anything people can be doing to sort of de-risk that idea and see what the income potentials could be from the idea?
Well, that exercise really does get to that issue, because I will tell you something. This may sound strange, but of all the different ways you can come up with a sales projection for your first year, you know, 6 months before you launch the company, one of the easiest ways is to figure out how much income do you want, and then to work back from that and see, is this realistic or not? And that's why we use that example of $30,000. That's not an unrealistic first-year income for some businesses. So I say start off with a realistic amount of money. Now, having said that, you want to be conservative. You don't want to take any more money out of the company the first year than you absolutely have to. So don't think, you know, you're on easy street here and you're going to take out every nickel that comes into the company. That's not a good strategy, because you need money to grow. But I'd start off with, what do you think would be a income level for your first year that's reasonable, and then figure out how much money you can make for a typical sale. If you don't know what that is, then arrange a call with me and we'll talk about it. I'll give you some ideas how to do that. So that really says, you know, we know that from that example that if she sold, if the jewelry artist sold 250 to 275 units of product, she'd be somewhere around $35,000 for the first year. And that's not bad.
Okay, great. And now we're starting to get some questions in, so thank you all for typing your feedback and your questions in. Sean wants to know, are there any legal implications when you're asking for feedback on your idea? So, for example, do you need to get a waiver signed to prevent a lawsuit where the person says using their feedback might be their idea?
That's a good question. There is the ability in SurveyMonkey to put a disclaimer in the survey that says that basically this will be used for some specific purpose. I rarely do I use survey results for public use, such as a testimonial. I use it for internal planning purposes only. So I'll say that on the survey form, but basically it's pretty clear from the disclaimer that if they agree to fill in the questions, they're giving us permission to at least look at the information.
Okay, makes sense. I have another question that says, what is a common percentage of profit imposed on clients of a travel tour business?
Are you saying what's the average profit that a travel tour company makes every year? I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have to find out, but I will tell you that service businesses in on average, if you look at all kinds of services like home cooking services and landscaping, they have pretty good profit margins. Many of them make 25 to 30% profit. You know, as compared to like a retail grocery store that only makes 3% profit, service companies make pretty good profit. Now, I will tell you what makes the best profit. Selling information and knowledge online, selling workbooks, selling ebooks, it's like 95% profit.
Oh, fantastic. That's helpful. So kind of going back to that service or selling your information or your knowledge, it seems like there's a consultant for everything these days. And, you know, if you're deciding to set up your consultancy, are there different ways to sort of stand out above everyone else?
Yes. Very good question. When someone comes to us and says that they want to be a consultant, the first thing we're looking at is what can they bring to us that's going to help us make them an expert. That's how you differentiate yourself. And quite often, it's a combination of doing several things. For example, blogging regularly on key issues of the industry will start to raise your profile. Getting the blogs published on large websites. For example, we have a client who's a health and safety consultant. And in the early years of his company, he built his reputation by getting a major industrial manufacturing website to publish the stories. Now, he had to write them. But all of a sudden, instead of being Ken, one of 1,000 safety consultants, he now became Ken, nationally known safety consultant. So this is how you rise up. You also can do this through publicity. About 9 years ago, I set a goal to become known nationally through the media as the number one guide for starting a business after 50. And I've had pretty success in doing that. How have I done it? By continually reaching out to the media. For example, back in June, the UVA news site did an interview with me and published a really great article about starting a business after 50. Well, I had to reach out to them. They didn't know who I was. I reached out to them. I said, I think I have a great story. You know, I'm an alum. Let's take a look at this. So I spend at least 10 hours a week reaching out to media with the intent of trying to make myself known as an expert.
Great. All right, good. So we're getting some more questions in. Rick has written in and said, how does the formula, so I think he's talking about the figuring out your income goal formula, how does that change if you're joining another sole proprietor as they're expanding their business and you're joining as like a 1099 contractor?
Okay, well, I wouldn't use the word joining if you're a 1099 contractor because joining infers that you're partnering in some way. If you're a 1099 contractor, you are just a service provider to them. You're like Norman Miller, who's my QuickBooks guy. He's a 1099 contractor to me, but he's not anywhere near a partner of mine. So the first question I'd ask you is, are you talking about partnering with this other individual to work out marketing strategy and sell, or are you just going to provide a basket of services to this company? Because if you are, then that's a very different relationship than if you're going to be involved in planning in the company. I will tell you that most of our consultants make at least 50% profit. At least 50% of every dollar they bring in goes to the bottom line. Because most of them work from home, which means they have no rent for office. They keep their expenses down. You know, their biggest expense in most cases is their cell phone bill every month for $150. So our clients are able to run large companies for $300 or $400 a month. So I think you can see that's a very high profit margin.
Okay, great. So Bill's written in and asked, what is a good way of structuring a startup when you're seeking money from others to fund startup costs like equipment or materials?
Well, there's some difference of opinion on this. When I launched BizStarters back in 1999, I went out looking for investment. And eventually, I got $100,000 from what's known as an angel investor. And in talking to my accountant, I had an accountant already at that time because I'd been in business for a while. She strongly recommended I set up a limited liability company known as an LLC. Now, why do we do this? Because I learned as time went on that LLCs have the most flexible relationship between the company owner and the investor. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in my case, the first year we were in business, BizStarter was in business, we made a little bit of profit. And normally, if you had an agreement with an investor, you would have to give him his percentage of the profit without any questions being asked. But in an LLC, you're allowed to go to your investor in writing and say, will you agree to let us defer our payment to you this year so we can use the money for marketing? And I did that. That is harder to do if you set up a corporation. Excuse me, in corporations, if your agreement is to pay this guy 20% of your profit, you pretty much have to pay it. But at LLC, you can flex it. And for the first 3 years we were in business, we asked permission to reinvest our profit every year, and he agreed.
Okay. Great. And Sean wrote in to ask, how did you find your angel investor?
A lot of hard work. At the time, I had an operational partner. He was an equity partner. He was based in Boston, and I'm here in Chicago. So we put together a very detailed business plan. Excuse me. Excuse me a second. It probably took us 4 or 5 weeks to do the business plan. It was about 60 pages long and it had full financials in it. He's a real numbers guy and I'm the marketing guy. So first thing we did is we really sold the case for the company. And then we started shopping it around. He went to people he knew in the venture capital community in Boston. I went to some people in California because I have relatives in Los Angeles, and then here in Chicago. And month after month went by, and we kept thinking, okay, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Well, finally, we thought we had a deal in Boston, and just before Christmas, it fell out. He just called us up one day and said, nope, I decided not to do it. So it got to be 1999, and I'm thinking, boy, oh, boy, this is not going to happen. And very quickly here, I got a call one day from a friend of mine in the Polish-American community here in Chicago. He said, you're still looking for money? I said, yes. He said, be at this address 7:30 on Saturday morning. I have somebody who's interested. And that's how I got the money. My angel investor was a multimillionaire that owned a manufacturing company, and he wanted to have a dot-com in his personal stock portfolio, and that's how I got the money.
Okay, great. So Jim has asked, when you're starting your own consulting business, how much do you have to spend on legal fees and individual contracts with clients? He seems to think that this might bog down the process of building your business.
Well, good news. There are very credible online sites that provide for free or for very low costs a pro forma contract forms today. What used to cost you $1,000 to have a lawyer draw up, a lot of it has already been done for you. And all you really need to do is go to a local attorney and decide which two or three paragraphs you need to customize in the contract, and you're ready to go. So for probably less than $300, you can have a customized contract, a client contract today. I use them myself in my coaching business. It kind of lays out what we're going to do, what the client has to do. It's got obligations. It's got benchmarks that we'll deliver. But we started with a contract that was a boilerplate contract, and then we had it customized. So it's much less expensive than it used to be.
Okay, great. And we've had someone else write in. When you're starting a new venture, how should someone approach the division of ownership slash equity among the initial founding members and any potential additional members that may come on as the venture prepares to launch?
Okay. Well, the first point here is that before you even get into the equity conversation, you need to sit down and honestly ask yourself, why are you partnering with these people? I will tell you some bad reasons to find a partner. Number one is you need money. That's not a good reason to take on a partner. There are other ways to find money. You can bring on a partner because they have money and find out a year later you do not get along with them. And I will tell you that a breakup in a business is just as messy as a divorce. It's very emotionally wrenching thing. So the first thing you need to do is say, why are we together? Do we have complementary skill sets? Is one of us the salesperson? One of us is the IT guy? If you suddenly discover that you want to partner with people who have the same skills you do, that's probably not a great idea. Number two is you need to have a partnership agreement. And this, once again, you can find these on the internet. And what it basically does is spells out how much money each of you will put in or some non-money thing. For example, somebody could bring website development skills, how you'll split the profit up, who will do each primary task, and most importantly, you need to have in your agreement, if you there's three of you and you have a disagreement, who will be the tiebreaker? Who will you go to outside your company to break the tie? Now, let's say you set it up that you're going to have 40% to one partner, 40% to another, and 20% to the third. When you decide to add someone, you have to be very careful because this creates a process called dilution, which means that suddenly the equity of the three original people can be diminished. So you have to be very careful. This would require a consultation with a CPA to figure out how to go about doing this. But first of all, you need to decide, are you right to partner with each other?
Okay, great. We just had another question come in. What do you spend on average, I'm assuming we'd want just an average number, on accountants that can guide you through tax, preparation and sort of handling the federal and state regulations that might be tied to your business?
Okay. A very good question. For 14 years, I used a partner in a mid-sized accounting firm here in Chicago because she's just an outstanding accountant. I really liked her, very commonsensical. Plus, she had a personality, and not all CPAs have a personality. But I paid a lot of money. I was paying them $3,000 a year to do a C corporation return, an LLC return, and my personal tax return. And every year I said to myself, I'm going to get a new accountant. Well, finally, she kind of forced me into it. 2 years ago, she retired as the partner. And at the same time, her company got acquired by an accounting firm in Cleveland. So suddenly I had no connection to them. So I ended up finding a solo practitioner here in my suburb. Well, it turns out that my accountant now, whose name is Jim, used to be with one of the top three accounting firms. This guy is very well trained. I now pay him $750 a year to do the three tax returns. Plus, I pay him an additional $250 a year in October to do tax planning with me. We just had the session last week. So I'm paying him a little over $1,000 a year for tax planning and preparing the tax returns. Now, let me say one last thing. In order to get him to agree to do the tax returns for $750, I have to agree to have absolutely well-organized QuickBooks records. If I do not give him my QuickBooks records on a disk, if they're not well-organized, he will charge me more money.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jeff. That was helpful. One of the questions that I had on my list is, you know, you mentioned the client that you worked with who set up her own website for her jewelry business, and it made me wonder, is there a benefit to having your own website versus maybe selling through eBay or Etsy or another sort of established marketplace website? Does it make a difference? Can you make money selling on both? Is there one that's better than the other?
Well, it's not a matter of what's better than the other. It's really kind of a matter of an evolution. And let me take Sue, the Wired Lotus lady. She started off as a semi-hobby with this about 6 years ago. And she didn't want to put a lot of money into it because she had a full-time job. She was doing this on the side. And her first product, as a matter of fact, wasn't a piece of jewelry. It was a video training course on how to make a certain kind of jewelry. Well, she didn't want to spend a lot of money, so she went to Etsy. Because with Etsy, you can set up your account in 20 minutes, and you're ready to sell. They take, I forget what percentage they take. I think they take 8% of your sales or whatever. So for her, that was great for the first 4 or 5 years because she was doing it part-time. But when she came to me, she had decided she had left her job, and she was going to run this business full-time. Well, at that point, she needed to start developing her own brand because the problem with Etsy is that your individual company name gets submerged with everything else that's on their website. People didn't really know she was called Wired Lotus when she was on Etsy. So we created her own web presence with that website I showed you. So it's a matter of evolution. If you're only going to do this 10 hours a week, I wouldn't spend the money on a website. I'd go to eBay or Etsy. But if you decided I really want to go after this and try to make $20,000, $30,000 a year, then you need your own website. Now, let me say one last thing. Some people come to me and say, what about these services like web.com where they'll build your website for free? Well, they do. The websites work, but I'll tell you the problem. If you decide sometime in the future that you're having problems with web.com, you cannot move that website anyplace else. They completely control the code for the website. Now, this may not happen to you ever, but it does happen. In my case, I had to change web hosting companies 3 times in 5 years because of customer service problems. If I had been on a website like that, and I don't mean to pick on web.com, they're a very good company, you cannot move the website. Whereas if you build your own website, like BizStarters is, I can move that anywhere I want, anytime I want.
Okay, great. And as a follow-up question to building your own business site, we had a question come in. How has your experience been with finding good developers to build out websites / online platforms, and any lessons learned that you'd like to share about how to manage good developers?
Yep. If I may be permitted with a little bit of a sales pitch here, this is the key part of what we do in Virtual Incubator. I have a team here in Chicago that does both the content writing and editing and also the website development. Every one of our startup clients has a fully functioning website. Okay. I will tell you this. The key today to getting a website up quickly and affordably is to use what's called WordPress. It's a software platform that's free. You do have to pay for the design tools that you use on WordPress, but for maybe $80 a year hosting fee, you can put up your own website in a couple weekends using WordPress. That's what we use for all of our clients, and that's what BizStarters is built on. It's built on WordPress. And the last thing I would say is that one of the areas where you can really run into expense with a web developer is not building the website, it's keeping it up to date. A lot of web developers will charge you $350 to $400 a month just to do what's called maintenance. If you have a WordPress site, you can learn how to do your own maintenance on the site, how to change headlines, how to put content in, how to put photos. That all can be learned very quickly on WordPress.
Okay, great. And then we have two more questions, and then we'll wrap up for the afternoon. One is fairly straightforward, and one is more of a scenario. So the first one, when you were taking the audience through the self-exploration activity, one of our participants missed the very first question that you are supposed to ask in the upper left-hand corner. So on the blank page, and you had them answer a question in the upper left-hand corner, can you remind him of what that question was?
Yes. Yeah, you want to write down 5 to 7 things you really like doing and or are really good
fantastic.
At doing.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jeff. And then here's the scenario. So when you bring on an angel investor or VC firm, whose pocket does the angel's percent of the firm come from? So the scenario is if you have a 60% equity stake and your co-founder has a 40% stake and you're going to give the angel a 5% stake, which is more than 100. does 3% come out of your part of the stake and 2% come from your partner's stake? Okay, I see where this is going. Making the new split 57-38-5. So I think it's, you know, if you have two founders and one's got 40, one's got 60, and you decide you're going to give this angel investor a 5% stake, who gives up what?
It's negotiable. There's no legal formula for doing this. It's all negotiable. And this is why you need to have a business attorney. If you're going to have an outside investor, I'm just telling you, you should have a relationship with a local attorney. It doesn't mean you have to have used them up to that point, but you at least should know you like them and that they're well recommended and that they're ready to be there. Because when you get into this kind of scenario, you need an intermediary who has had a lot of experience in this. It's really negotiable. For example, I've seen this situation occur where one of the partners, the partner that had, say, the 40%, he was really the sales driver for the company. He was what they call the rainmaker. And out of consideration for that fact, the majority equity owner said, I will give up all of the investors' equity out of my share of the company.
Okay.
So it was negotiated.
Great. I just want to give a huge thank you to Jeff for the second webinar and for always having such a robust Q&A with the audience. We always appreciate that, and we appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. And that's all for today. Thank you again from Alumni Career Services here at UVA's Alumni Association.